I first became aware of the case through a file that arrived without urgency, but carried a weight that only grows heavier with time, because it involved a woman who had not missed work, not missed calls, and not missed obligations, until she suddenly did, leaving behind a silence that felt out of place in a life described as structured and consistent. And as I reviewed what was officially confirmed, I saw how that silence forced others to speak on her behalf through bank records, schedules, and small routine markers that normally never need explanation, all of which pointed not to chaos, but to an interruption, one that did not announce itself with violence or noise, yet still managed to fracture a household, a workplace, and eventually an entire community. Because when a person vanishes, without explanation, the absence becomes its own presence, filling rooms and conversations, and demanding answers that cannot be improvised, only traced, step by step, through what remains. And it was only after the search had unfolded, after assumptions had hardened and evidence had narrowed, that the woman at the center of this disappearance could finally be named as Trina Hunt. Before Trina Hunt was reported missing, everything officially documented about her life suggested predictability rather than conflict. And that consistency is what first drew attention when she failed to appear where she was expected to be. I reviewed her employment records, her attendance history, and statements from coworkers, all of which described a person who did not disappear without notice, because she communicated clearly, arrived on time, and treated obligations as fixed points rather than flexible options. When someone like that is suddenly absent, the deviation itself becomes evidence that something has changed. Trina lived in Port Moody, British Columbia, a suburban community where routines are visible because neighborhoods are small enough for patterns to be noticed. The residence she shared with her husband, Ian Hunt, was not described in reports as chaotic or transient, but is settled, and that detail matters because it frames the expectations investigators bring to the first hours of a disappearance. There were no really indicators of relocation, no plans disclosed to employers or friends, and no financial activity suggesting a voluntary departure. I examined the initial timeline as it was reconstructed through verified statements, beginning with the days immediately preceding her disappearance, and what stood out was how little variation existed in her schedule. Trina worked for a local engineering firm, and colleagues later confirmed that she had not expressed fear, intent to leave, or concern about her personal safety. Those confirmations did not explain what happened, but they narrowed what could reasonably be assumed. When Trina did not show up for work and did not respond to messages, concern escalated quickly, not because of dramatic behavior, but because of its absence. Employers attempted contact, coworkers reached out, and when those efforts failed, the situation moved beyond personal concern and into formal reporting. This transition is often where uncertainty enters, but in this case, the reporting was prompt and documented. Port Moody Police Department opened a missing person investigation shortly after Trina was reported absent, and I reviewed their public statements alongside internal procedural notes that were later confirmed. Officers conducted welfare checks, contacted known associates, and began establishing a last known timeline based on phone data, credit card usage, and witness confirmation. At this stage, there was no classification of criminal activity, only the acknowledgement that a person was missing without explanation. The shared residence became a focal point early, not because of immediate evidence of wrongdoing, but because it represented the last confirmed location tied to Trina's routine. Investigators confirmed that her vehicle was present, her personal belongings were not packed, and there were no signs of a planned trip. These facts were verified through physical inspection and inventory, not assumption, and they collectively suggested that Trina had not left voluntarily. Ian Hunt, her husband, spoke with investigators during the early phase, providing statements that were logged and preserved. According to confirmed records, he described seeing Trina on the evening before her disappearance and later discovering she was gone. His account did not immediately conflict with physical evidence, but it also did not provide clarity about where she might have gone or why. Search efforts expanded as days passed, involving ground searches, volunteer coordination, and public appeals. I reviewed the official releases requesting information, which were carefully worded to avoid speculation, focusing instead on confirmed identifiers and last known movements. Trina's image circulated widely, not because of sensational framing, but because the circumstances lacked resolution. Friends and coworkers described her publicly as private, routine-oriented, and dependable. And while those descriptors are subjective, they were consistent across multiple independent statements. Investigators treat such consistency cautiously, but when repeated across unrelated sources, it reinforces the baseline understanding of a person's behavior prior to disappearance. As the investigation continued without immediate results, attention remained focused on reconstructing Trina's final confirmed interactions. Phone records were examined for outgoing and incoming communication, financial accounts were monitored for activity, and surveillance footage in surrounding areas was reviewed where available. None of these produced a definitive explanation, but they helped rule out certain scenarios. The absence of financial movement was particularly notable, because it suggested that Trina was not accessing funds after she was last seen, which reduced the likelihood of voluntary disappearance. That conclusion was not stated as certainty, but as probability, grounded in confirmed account monitoring. Community involvement increased as official updates remained limited, and while public interest grew, investigators maintained control of verified information, releasing only what could be confirmed. This restraint was deliberate, intended to protect the integrity of the investigation rather than accelerate narrative conclusions. As weeks passed, the classification of the case shifted in tone, if not in formal designation, because the lack of contact became prolonged. Missing persons cases often hinge on early discoveries, and when those do not materialize, the investigative posture changes from immediate recovery to long-term resolution. Throughout this period, no public accusations were made and no charges were laid, but the focus narrowed naturally toward those closest to Trina, not as suspects, but as sources of information. This is standard procedure, and I reviewed training materials that confirm this approach, because proximity often yields context rather than culpability. By the end of the initial phase, the investigation had established what Trina Hunt had not done more clearly than what had happened to her. She had not withdrawn money, not traveled, not contacted anyone, and not altered her routine voluntarily. These absences, documented and confirmed, formed the foundation for everything that followed, even though at that stage, there was still no confirmed outcome. By the time the investigation reached its second phase, the absence of Trina Hunt had shifted from unexplained to untenable, because the passage of time without contact, activity, or credible sightings had narrowed the range of outcomes investigators were required to consider. I was reviewing confirmed updates as they were released, and internal procedural summaries as they were later made public, and what became clear was that the case had moved beyond the expectation of return and into the obligation to locate, regardless of condition. That shift is never announced formally, but it is reflected in how resources are deployed and how questions are asked. Search operations expanded geographically, guided by information that could be verified, rather than theories that could not. Ground searches were conducted in surrounding wooded areas. Waterways were examined where access points existed, and tips from the public were cataloged and assessed based on corroboration. I examined logs showing how each tip was handled, and while many led nowhere, the process itself revealed the degree to which the investigation had become methodical rather than reactive. Throughout this period, there were no public declarations of criminal responsibility, and that restraint mattered because nothing recovered at that point supported a definitive conclusion about what had happened to Trina. Investigators continued to focus on reconstructing her last confirmed movements, which remained limited to her home and routine communications. The lack of external footage, transactions, or communications meant the case remained inward-facing, centered on what could be confirmed within her immediate environment. In June of 2021, information emerged that redirected the investigation decisively, and this shift was documented through official police statements rather than speculation. Human remains were located near Hope, British Columbia, an area significantly removed from Trina's home in Port Moody. The discovery was not the result of a new witness coming forward publicly, but of investigative developments that were not fully disclosed at the time, consistent with standard practice when a case is still active. The confirmation that the remains belonged to Trina Hunt came after forensic examination and that confirmation altered the legal classification of the case while still leaving key questions unresolved. I reviewed the language used in official releases, which was careful to distinguish between discovery and determination, because while remains had been found, the circumstances surrounding her death were not publicly detailed. This distinction is often misunderstood, but it is critical in understanding what investigators are allowed to say and what they are still working to confirm. With the recovery of Trina's remains, attention returned to the timeline between her disappearance and the discovery, specifically focusing on actions taken during that interval that could be verified. Investigators examined transportation data, travel records, and any available surveillance that might account for how her remains came to be located where they were found. These reviews were grounded in evidence rather than inference, and they revealed a sequence of actions that were later addressed through the courts. Ian Hunt was arrested in connection with the case, not on a charge of murder, but on a charge related to the indignity of human remains. This distinction was explicit in court documents and police statements, and I reviewed those records to ensure accuracy, because public perception often fills gaps that the legal system does not. The charge reflected what could be proven regarding conduct after Trina's death, not the cause of her death itself. Court proceedings established that Trina's remains had been transported and left in the Hope area, and that this action formed the basis of the charge. The legal focus was narrow by necessity, because criminal charges must align with evidence that meets a defined standard. I reviewed summaries of the plea entered in court, which confirmed that Ian Hunt pleaded guilty to the charge, resolving that portion of the case within the judicial system. Throughout this phase, investigators and prosecutors avoided statements about motive or cause of death that could not be substantiated in court. This restraint often leaves the public dissatisfied, but it reflects the boundary between investigation and adjudication. What could be confirmed was addressed legally, and what could not remained outside the scope of formal judgment. The discovery of Trina's remains answered the question of where she was, but it did not answer how she died, or why events unfolded as they did. Those unanswered questions were acknowledged implicitly through the limited nature of the charges, and explicitly through statements emphasizing that the investigation had addressed what evidence allowed, no more and no less. As I reviewed the conclusion of the investigative phase, what stood out was not a dramatic revelation, but a narrowing of certainty. The case did not resolve into a complete narrative, but into a set of confirmed facts bounded by legal outcomes. Trina Hunt was no longer missing. Her remains had been recovered, and responsibility had been assigned for actions taken after her death, even as other aspects remained legally unaddressed. This phase of the case marked the transition from active search to documented resolution, not because every question had been answered, but because the investigative process had reached the limits of what evidence could support. That transition is often misinterpreted as closure, but in reality, it represents the end of one obligation and the beginning of another. The obligation to record accurately what is known, and to refrain from asserting what cannot be proven. By the time the court proceedings concluded, the case had become defined not by speculation, but by restraint, because the official record reflected only what could withstand scrutiny. Trina Hunt's disappearance had led to a discovery, and that discovery had led to accountability within a specific legal framework, even as broader questions remained outside the reach of confirmation. After the court proceedings concluded, the Trina Hunt case entered its final documented phase, not because every question had been resolved, but because the legal system had reached the boundary of what could be formally addressed. I reviewed the sentencing records, public court summaries, and official statements that followed, and what emerged was a clear distinction between investigative completion and narrative completion, because the former does not guarantee the latter. The case closed procedurally, but its factual outline remained deliberately narrow. Ian Hunt was sentenced in relation to the charge of indignity to human remains, a charge defined by specific actions that occurred after Trina's death, rather than the cause of her death itself. The court records confirmed the plea, the sentencing outcome, and the legal reasoning applied, and those documents became the final authoritative account of accountability within this case. There were no additional charges announced, and no further prosecutions followed, which signaled the conclusion of formal criminal proceedings. The cause of Trina Hunt's death was not publicly established through court findings, and I reviewed the statements issued by investigators to confirm that this absence of determination was intentional rather than incidental. Where evidence does not meet the threshold required to support a charge, investigators are obligated to refrain from inference, even when public interest demands explanation. In this case, that restraint defined the final record. The investigative file, as it stands, confirms several core facts without expansion beyond them. Trina Hunt disappeared from her home in Port Moody in January 2021. She did not engage in financial activity or communication after that point. Her remains were discovered near Hope, British Columbia, in June 2021. Her husband was charged and convicted for conduct involving the handling of her remains. These points are not debated within the official record, and they form the complete framework of confirmed events. What remains outside that framework is equally important, because the absence of formal conclusions regarding motive or cause of death is not an oversight, but a boundary. I reviewed how investigators and prosecutors addressed this publicly, and they consistently emphasized what could be proven rather than what could be assumed. This approach often leaves unresolved space, but it preserves the integrity of the record. In cases like this, public understanding is often shaped by inference, but inference does not replace evidence. The investigative materials I examined showed careful attention to documenting what was known and separating it from what could not be established conclusively. That separation is rarely satisfying, but it is essential to accuracy. The impact of the case extended beyond the courtroom into the community, though that impact was documented through responses rather than conclusions. Trina's disappearance and the later discovery of her remains altered how missing person cases were discussed locally. Not because of a shift in policy, but because of heightened awareness. This awareness, while significant socially, did not alter the legal outcome, which remained fixed. I reviewed statements issued by law enforcement after sentencing, and they reflected a consistent tone of closure without commentary. Investigators acknowledged the resolution of charges and reiterated that the case had been handled according to evidence and law. There were no announcements of further investigative action and no indication that additional findings were pending. From an investigative perspective, the conclusion of this case demonstrates how resolution is sometimes defined by limits rather than answers. The obligation to locate Trina Hunt was fulfilled. The obligation to address provable criminal conduct was fulfilled. The obligation to avoid unsupported conclusions was also fulfilled. These obligations coexist, even when they leave gaps. The record shows that investigators did not publicly speculate about Trina's final moments, her state of mind, or the circumstances leading to her death. That restraint preserved factual clarity, even though it prevented merit of completeness. I reviewed training guidance and case comparisons, and this approach aligns with established standards when evidentiary thresholds are not met. What remains, therefore, is a case defined by documentation rather than dramatization. The confirmed timeline, the recovered remains, and the adjudicated charge form a closed system of facts. Outside that system, there is silence, not because information was withheld improperly, but because it did not exist in a form that could be proven. Trina Hunt's case is recorded not as an unsolved homicide, but as a resolved legal matter with unresolved circumstances. That distinction matters because it defines how the case is referenced in official records and how it is classified historically. The absence of a murder conviction is not a suggestion of outcome, but a statement of legal reality. As I reviewed the final file entries, what stood out was the consistency of language used from beginning to end. Investigators did not shift tone or posture as public attention increased. They did not expand claims as pressure mounted. They maintained a narrow evidentiary focus, even when that focus limited the narrative. This consistency reinforces the credibility of the record, even as it leaves unanswered questions. The purpose of an investigation is not to construct meaning, but to establish fact. And in this case, that purpose was fulfilled within defined constraints. The case file now exists as a closed record, accessible through court documents, police releases, and archived reporting. What remains is fixed, bounded by what was confirmed, and resistant to reinterpretation without new evidence. Trina Hunt is no longer missing. Her remains were recovered. Legal responsibility for specific actions was assigned and adjudicated. Beyond those facts, the record does not extend. That is where the case ends, not with interpretation or conclusion, but with documentation.